And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We love doing this podcast because we have the opportunity to bring the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today we have an opportunity to talk to Dr. Paul Gould. And we've had him on the podcast before, and he lives up to every billing we could possibly give him. He's a philosopher, a scholar, a teacher, a husband. He's the father of four. He's a professor of philosophy of religion. He's the founder and president of Two Tasks Institute. He has a PhD in philosophy from Purdue University. And I could say a whole lot more about his credentials, but I'm going to leave it at that. To the point of this podcast, he has written many books, but I think a book that has really captured our attention at the Christian Research Institute, a book titled A Good and True Story, subtitled 11 Clues to Understanding Our Universe and Your Place in It. And by the way, Dr. Gould is a contributor to Christian Research Journal, and we have a deep and abiding appreciation for him on many counts. But this is one of those areas that he really helps us get a hold of. He gives us a way of understanding something that is oftentimes confusing to people. And this is the issue of origins. I've often said throughout my ministry that how one views their origins ultimately will determine how they live their life. If you think you're a function of random chance, that you arose from the primordial slime, you're going to live your life by a different standard than if you know that you're created in the image of God and accountable to Him. David said that the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. St. Paul said, God's eternal power, His divine nature, clearly seen through what has been made. So there are a couple of stories about origins, and we're going to discuss that today. But first, let me say welcome, Dr. Gould. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Hank. It's great to be back with you. Looking forward to our conversation today.
Yeah, maybe I should ask you a basic question, a good and true story. What prompted you to write this particular book?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because that can kind of segue from some earlier work to this one. In 2019, I wrote a book called Cultural Apologetics. I know we've talked about it on this podcast. And in that book, one of the sort of more hopeful or prescriptive parts of the book, I argued that given God's intentions for humans, that He loves us, that He pursues us, that He cares for us, He wants us to find, you know, faith and be redeemed in Him. Given this intention for humans, I had this prescriptive, sort of more hopeful idea that God could redeem culture in a way. And the language I use is that we would work with God and the Holy Spirit and each other to re-enchant the world. And in that, I argued that we, number one, awaken longing for the things of God. And there's various things that I talk about in that book there. And then number two, returning to reality. In other words, that we would begin to see the world as it actually is. And there, I said two things. How do we return to reality? I said, number one, as Christians, that we would see and delight in God and all things in relation to God the way Jesus does, so that we as Christians would learn to see and delight in the world the way Jesus does. And number two, that we would learn to invite others to see and delight in the world the way Jesus does. And those two claims are two future book projects, of which the one we're talking about today is related to the second idea. How can we help those who don't yet know Christ look at the world in such a way that they see it, that they interpret it correctly, and that it points to and is evocative of the divine? So that's kind of the heart behind it. If the 2019 book was a book about cultural apologetics written for Christians, this book, A Good and True Story, is a book, what I would call a book of cultural apologetics written to non-believers.
So two things that you do in this book. One is you give us signposts. Two is you introduce us to Lady Nature. So Lady Nature is a guide in a theistic worldview where sometimes we hear about Mother Nature, who's a replacement for God in a pagan worldview.
Yeah, so one of the things that I wanted to do, so there's actually a couple theses that are informing the way that I wrote this book. And one is a thesis about reality itself. And then there's actually a thesis about humans, and then I have a thesis about evidence. But the thesis about reality itself is that reality is an ongoing story, right? And like any good story, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's why you're right. The question of origins will, you know, figure prominently in the book because of this idea that we are part of a story. So that's the first thesis. The second is a thesis about humans. And that's something that philosophers and sociologists and literary critics and historians and theologians have noted is that humans, they say that we are narratival animals, that we're creatures that live our lives according to a story. And so we basically come into the world and we begin to immediately seek a story from which we can understand our identity and our purpose and our meaning. And so we're on this quest. And so that's kind of the idea, is that we're on this quest to discover the true story of the world. And in writing the book, one cool thing that I found out when I was exploring the great questions of origin, right? The origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of species, and the origin of humans, was that in medieval travelogues, they would often call on this personification of Lady Nature, basically. And Lady Nature would serve as a guide in these medieval travelogues to help people, look and notice and correctly interpret the world around them. And so in wanting to engage our imaginations as we embark on this quest, I thought that it would be important to have guides. And so Lady Nature, given the first four chapters are on the origins of, you know, the world, the physical universe that we find ourselves in, she basically is the guide that is helping us, is pointing, saying, look at this, what best explains this, that kind of thing.
And then you're talking about signposts as well, or cairns.
That's right. So yeah, good. So, and actually that gets to the third thesis. If there's a thesis about reality that undergirds this, that reality is a kind of story. There's a thesis about human persons, and that's the idea that we are on a quest to locate our lives within the true story. The thesis about evidence is that it's widely available. So, evidence is everywhere. I think that anything and everything points to in some way the divine, but it needs to be rightly interpreted, right? So sometimes Stephen Evans, for example, is a philosopher at Baylor, says that the evidence for God is widely available, but easily resistible. And what he means by the easily resistible part is that it's everywhere, but it needs to be rightly interpreted. And that's why we need the guides. And so what I wanted to do was take 11 clues, 11 signposts that I think powerfully point to the true story of the world in a sort of special way. And I wanted to help the reader sort of focus on each of those. And then the metaphor, the central metaphor of the book, was that each of these clues or signs is kind of like those cairns on a journey when you're kind of hiking in the mountains, where you need the cairns to kind of guide you to the summit. And so each of these rocks individually, I think, is a sign or a clue. But then as you stack them up together, it helps us find our way, you know, to our destination, which is to discover that true story of the world.
These cairns are going to be important for the rest of our life, not just for a podcast, because when the winds and the waves of doubt beat upon our house of faith, you can go back to those cairns. You can go back to those signposts and say, this is why I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. They give us, you know, the guardrails. They, I've once heard it, you know, if the great theological virtues are faith, hope, and love, you know, faith is that which gives us eyes to see the path, but hope is that which sustains us on the path when life gets hard. Right. And so we need faith, hope. And then of course, love is the thing that we're destining with and toward ultimately in God. But you're right. Like the walk of faith, the walk of life is hard, and we need help. We need guides. We need clues. We need signs. And thankfully we need hope. And as it turns out on the Christian story, as you know, we read in 1 Peter 1:3, that hope is a living hope, right? It's one that we can actually bank our lives on. And that's a good thing in a world, you know, otherwise there is no hope, and we're going to have angst and despair and a whole bunch of other stuff.
So you say there are two stories, and the one story is taken just as seriously as the other story in the book. It's not as though you say, well, there's only one story, it's the Christian story, but you say there's the non-religious story. So give us some of the guideposts, as it were, by which people say, I believe the non-religious story, scientism, materialism, reductionism, and so forth.
Yeah, good. So, you know, I thought it would be helpful to kind of have a foil as we're kind of exploring these pieces of evidence, these clues, these signs. And one of the dominant foils, at least in the West, is the conversation that's taking place between the religious and the non-religious, or the theistic and the atheistic worldviews. And so in the beginning, I just kind of set these out as our two generic stories, right? You've got the theistic version of the religious story, you know, which has God as the central figure, a personal being that's worthy of worship. And then on the non-religious view, at least in the West, the way that it's typically understood is it's a kind of story that begins with matter or something like that. And then if you wanted a narratival arc, it would be, you know, that we humans arrive in this world late and local, at least on Earth, as far as we know, and we're kind of vulnerable selves. And so we immediately try to buffer ourselves from the ravages of the world and the ravages of each other through technology. And there's a whole bunch of philosophical assumptions to both of these views. And the five that I just sort of unpack briefly as we begin this journey for the non-religious view are pretty dominant, at least in the West, in our culture. And those would be, number one, a theory about knowledge. It's called scientism, but it's just the idea in the weak form that our best knowledge comes from the sciences. That's a pretty dominant view out there. That often is thought to entail, number two, materialism, or what I would better be called physicalism. And that's the idea that all that exists are material things, or all that exists is that which physics tells us exists. Number three, that often is thought to entail atheism. We're sometimes told that if science is our best or only source of knowledge, and that entails only what physics says, well, then somehow that entails that God doesn't exist. So there's an atheistic strand here. And then, of course, that would lead to a theory about meaning, that there is no meaning. So that would be nihilism. And then there's also this impulse within much of the sciences and much of the academy for reductionism, right? That you're nothing but, as Sean Carroll, I think he puts it wonderfully in his book, The Big Picture, written from a non-religious or naturalist or atheistic perspective. He says humans are nothing but organized mud, right? And so you have the nothing buttery. We're just reduced to the little parts, whatever the little parts happen to be. And so that's one story. And then I put that in contrast with a broadly theistic story as we begin this journey.
How important is it to learn to ask the right questions and maybe even ask them in the right sequence?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it's super important. You know, Aristotle said that if we want, and this is a really bad paraphrase, if we want to be successful in life, we need to learn to ask the right preliminary questions, right? So if you think about it, everyone longs for happiness, as Pascal says. Even the person who hangs himself wants to be happy, he just thinks that that's how he will become happy. And Aristotle's point was, well, it all depends on what happiness is, right? We've got to ask these preliminary questions. Can we know it? Is it attainable? What is it? And that's a skill in our largely anti-intellectual culture and our largely information-driven, internet-driven culture, now that we have, you know, AI doing the thinking for us, perhaps, that art of asking good questions is rapidly disappearing. And with that, though, our inability for wisdom, right? And to live life the way that we ought. So it's super important. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that.
Yeah, so let's get right into it and tackle each one of these cairns, each one of these signposts, each one of these piles of rocks that we can look back to when we're shaken in our faith. I run into so many people. I was talking to a young man just the other day, and he said, you know, science has shaken my faith once again. So when that happens, you can go back to these signposts, the first of which is the universe. Talk about the universe and why there is something as opposed to there being nothing at all.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I thought it would be, you know, if we're beginning with Lady Nature, if we're looking at the four great origin debates, right, because we're looking at the beginning of the story, I thought it would be important, not only for everyone else, but because I find them super interesting topics in their own right, is to look at the origin of the universe, life, species, and humans. And when it comes to the universe itself, there's at least four facts that immediately cry out more that you know, as we begin to learn about certain features of the universe. Number one, that the universe is contingent. And all that means is that it exists, but it didn't have to exist, right? It, in the same way that I'm contingent, I exist, but maybe my parents, if they never met or if they never had kids, I would not have existed, right? So I'm a contingent being. As it turns out, the universe is a contingent thing. It exists, but it didn't have to. So that's a fact that cries out for explanation. Number two, it's temporally finite. You know, standard Big Bang cosmology tells us that the universe began a finite time ago. Number three, and this was actually mind-boggling to me, was it's just immense, right? It's, you know, on average, they think there's 100 billion galaxies with 100 billion stars each. It's an immense universe with an immense amount of matter and stars and things like that. And then number four, it's finely tuned for life. And these four facts again, cry out for explanation. And this is where you enter back into the story of the two competing views, right? Are these facts best explained by science, or maybe they have no explanation, or is the theistic explanation the best explanation? And I argue that these four facts are best explained given the reality of a personal being that is God.
I think in the context of the discussion, it's probably worthwhile to bring out the Kalam cosmological argument. And by the way, I don't want people to get the impression that when you read this book, you're reading a manual. You powerfully use the power of story to communicate logical truth propositions. And maybe you should cash that out first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, given what I argue apologetics or cultural apologetics should be, where we engage the reason and the imagination, where we respect people as fully embodied humans that make culture and are shaped by culture, you know, that we're creatures with emotions and imaginations and things like that. I wanted to write a story that helped people awaken to the goodness and truth and beauty of the Christian story, and to be at awe, because these features of the world that we're looking at, the leaven, actually are, they, as Plato would say, with respect to philosophy, philosophy begins in wonder. Well, I think it's the same thing for the true story of the world. As we look at these features of the world, they ought to awaken in us a sense of wonder that sets us on a journey of discovery. So yeah, you're right. As a trained philosopher who teaches philosophy, I love syllogisms. But as a human being and trying to love my neighbor, I want to help. I write this not for my peers, right, my fellow philosophers, but I write this as public-facing kind of philosophy. And so I write it with other epistemic values, including clarity, winsome. I share a lot of my own personal journey and things like that. So you're right. It's not strictly, although it's all there, I'm trying to communicate it in a special way.
Yeah. So the cosmological argument, Kalam. Yeah.
Right. So this is a wonderful argument that's super easy. It actually is. You could two premises and a conclusion. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Premise two, the universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. And then as you look at the nature of the cause, that cause basically starts to sound a lot like the theistic God. And the way that science, you mentioned, you know, your friend that you're talking to that said somehow science is making him think that God doesn't exist again. You know, that is a kind of thought that's out there a lot in culture. But if we think about, you know, the question is, how does science actually function with respect to the debates over ultimate reality? And the way that I would say it is that the empirical evidence from science serves as evidence in a philosophical premise that leads to a theological conclusion, right? So the empirical evidence, for example, that the universe is finite temporally, that it began, is evidence that we have from Big Bang cosmology, the expansion of the universe because of redshift and the microwave background radiation that we see all over the universe. These are data points that function as evidence in support of a premise, premise two in the Kalam argument, that has a theological conclusion. And so that's what's behind one. There's actually three arguments that I'm presenting in that chapter, but that's one of them related to the temporal finitude of the universe.
So you talk about the immensity of the universe you just mentioned. Now they're saying the universe has trillions of galaxies, each with billions of stars. The universe is maybe 100 billion light years in diameter. Multiply that by 5.9 trillion, you have the number of miles, but it's immense. It's incomprehensible. But how does that become a signpost toward God?
Well, yeah, good. So what's kind of interesting, in one way, the immensity, the sheer numbers, the sheer immensities, to me, it actually awakens awe and wonder. And that's just autobiographical. When I consider this, it's just mind-boggling, and it causes me to ask this question. And it's actually a question that has been debated since at least Copernicus, but probably forever, as we've been thinking, is, does the universe care about humans at all, right? Is there any reason to think that I matter? And so you have, like, on the non-religious story, one of the guiding principles is something called the principle of indifference. And that actually, like, you can see this in Richard Dawkins and many who will just say the universe cares nothing for humans, right? And I think the immensity of the universe causes us to ask that question, does the universe care for us? And so you have a number of atheists that give these really kind of odd arguments from smallness. And it goes something like this. They're actually bad arguments, but they're like, the universe is really big and humans are really small. Therefore, the universe doesn't care for us, right? You know, there's no point to the universe. And of course, you know, that's not a good argument, but there is this sense in the immensity of the universe that we're trying to locate our place within this. What does it mean to be humans in an immense universe? And as far as we know, there is no other life as far as we know, right? Earth is the only place where we already discovered that. And minds like ours are really late and really local in that story. And so that question just becomes front and center when I consider the history and the scope of the universe. So I wanted to include that as well.
Yeah, sometimes you hear the argument that we're just a speck on a speck in the middle of specklessness. The immensity of the universe makes us meaningless, and you sort of allude to that. But in reality, I think one of the things, I mean, this is not part of the book, but something maybe you can comment on. I oftentimes think that if we only lived for 70, 80 years, being around for a short period of time in an immense universe may point to our meaninglessness. But the fact is, we were created for eternity. We're not just exploring this universe for a short period of time, but forever. I think just as we never come to an end of exploring the immensity of God, so we'd never come to an end of exploring the immensity of the universe which he created. And he's going to recreate the universe now, Paul says, groans in travail, awaiting its liberation from decay. And this is going to be restored, and we're going to spend an eternity exploring God and God's created handiwork.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually got a lot of sympathy for that. That sounds about right to me, right? These are some of the great questions that we all have, right? What will we be doing in the new heavens and the new earth? But there is this proposal. Actually, one of the books I edited, The Story of the Cosmos, Gonzalo, I can't say his name without looking
Guillermo.
At it, but yeah, there you go. Guillermo Gonzalez. Yeah. He wrote a chapter on the exoplanets and, you know, the question of, are there other planets that are Earth-like where we could find possible life? But in there, he actually ran that proposal that what we will be doing in the eschaton is interstellar travel, which we'll have plenty of time, right? And exploring the universe around us. And I resonate with that. I mean, obviously we're speculating, but there's something that seems profoundly right about that. When you ask questions like, why this universe, and why is the universe the way it is, and why is it so immense that we don't even have, we have all these distinctions that we need to make, right? We have the observable universe and the unobservable universe. Now astronomers are talking about the affectable universe, right? Even if we can observe it, we can't affect all of it from where we sit today on Earth, given current technology, but who knows in the eschaton.
Let's talk about life, a very important Karen signpost in your book. I think that it probably does us well to consider the fact that in the non-religious story, there's this idea that nothing creates everything, that life comes from non-life, and that the life that comes from non-life produces metaphysical realities. In the religious story, we say, we have to ask a question, and that question is, what is life and what constitutes life?
Right. I mean, life itself is an amazing feature of the world, right? And again, it's something that we only are aware of in one place, in a very humdrum galaxy in the middle of, you know, a cluster of galaxies in some corner of the universe. And so there is this question, what is so special about this place that life, number one, arose? And it does, of course, beg this preliminary question, what is life? And actually, in all of the chapters in this book, because of this, you know, Aristotle's thought that we must ask the right preliminary questions. In every chapter, I usually begin with, you know, what is the nature of the thing in question that we're looking at? And so I spend a great bit of time in the beginning here. What is the nature of life, right? Is it what biology tells us, you know, and kind of look at some of that and kind of arrive at a philosophical definition that seems helpful, because in getting to the nature of life, it actually gives us a clue, I think, about how life came about. So,
yeah. So how did life begin? What's the problem for the view that life comes from non-life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so, you know, you're right. If the non-religious story and all those kind of philosophical presuppositions that I mentioned earlier is true, somehow you got to get life from non-life with natural processes. And that has a number of hurdles. It's so interesting in the literature on this. You have kind of dueling confidence, right? You have those from a non-religious perspective that are very confident that it's just sort of a math problem and that we're eventually going to figure out how we get life from non-life. And then you have others like Jim Tor, who's one of the leading, you know, synthetic chemists in the world, who's saying, you're all lying. Nobody knows how life can come from non-life. You know, it's an incredibly intractable problem. And so it's hard for like the non-scientist to kind of know what to do with that. But there's at least three problems that are really seem intractable for the purely naturalistic explanation on the non-religious story. And that would be like the location question, like where did life begin, right? Again, we only know one location that has life, and that's the Earth. And so there's all these postulations, where would Darwin's little warm pond be? And there's a number, there's about 8 to 10 earthly suggestions, and then some punt to outer space. Maybe it came from outer space or asteroids or things like that. So that's a problem, though. Nobody really knows, number one. But number two, there's what I call in the book the ingredients problem, right? How do we get the basic building blocks for life from purely naturalistic processes, right? We need proteins, we need genetic material, we need lipids, we need all these sort of subparts of these macromolecules. And no origin of life experiment has been able to produce any of the macromolecules at all. They've been able to get some of the subparts, but the way that they set up the experiments, they weren't, you know, realistic with respect to early Earth atmosphere and early Earth conditions. So yeah, the location problem, the ingredients problem. And then even if you were to get these ingredients, you have the assembly problem. Because as we know now, right, the more we learn from science, the cell, which, you know, the first living organism was a single cell. Cells are incredibly complex machines. Many times people use the metaphor of a factory to explain the cell. And so you have all these problems with how do you assemble the cell, even if you had all the basic parts. And when you run the numbers on these things, it just seems intractable, given purely naturalistic and blind processes.
Yeah. So if you were to summarize this cairn, this signpost, what would you say? What's the significance of the life issue?
Yeah, I think that we had this intuition that life is something incredibly valuable. We even would use the word sacred. You know, when we're pre-philosophical, apart from being told by some, you know, view out there, our intuition, our pre-philosophical intuition is that there's something very special, even sacred about life, that it ought to be protected. You can run thought experiments about this, right? Imagine a world just like ours, except that we eradicate all living beings, right? I think the intuition is fairly clear that that would be a world of lesser value, right? And so here we have something of incredible value that is easy to destroy, but we have no idea how to produce it, how it came about. And so given the sacredness of this phenomena, again, it cries out for explanation, right? That's what's so significant about life, I think.
Yeah, and that leads me to the third cairn, or the third signpost, which is species. Darwin wrote a book, The Origin of Species. Here you have a chapter which points out that Darwin's tree of life is uprooted by the Cambrian radiation or the Cambrian explosion. So you have biology's Big Bang. That's very important to the religious story, just like cosmology's Big Bang is.
Right. Yeah. And this was an interesting chapter. You know, in some circles, it's become really hard to talk about evolution and to do it sort of, you know, charitably and with sort of intellectual humility. But if you kind of set that aside for a minute and just think about the sheer diversity of life. So we talked about life and this intuition that it's something of great value. When you add to that the fact that the diversity of life that we've had on Earth is incredible. In fact, like this really sobering statistic as I was researching for this chapter was 99% of all species that have existed have become extinct, right? And that's again, mind-boggling how much diversity this world has seen since life began. Yeah, so to your question, we have one of the lines of evidence that's often debated when it comes to what explains the diversity of life, right? Is it evolution and Darwin or neo-Darwinian accounts? Or is there some sort of like a need for God to infuse information in the causal joints to get the species? One of the pieces of evidence has been the fossil record because of, as you just talked about, biology's Big Bang. We have this period in time where you have this sudden appearance of many, many life forms, fully formed, without any appearance of transitional forms that, you know, would help the evolutionary story. And so this becomes something that's, again, what best explains the data, right? And so I had a section in the book on the fossil record and kind of walking through the different options. And I took it out at the last moment because it was getting too technical. I mean, I just wanted to focus on the microbiology and the genetic kind of lines of evidence. But when it comes to the fossil record, you have, you know, when Darwin wrote in 1859 and he continued to revise The Origin of Species, he says, you know, right now the fossil record is substantially incomplete and it doesn't reveal any transitional forms. But if in some future date, when we do have the full or complete fossil record and we still don't have those transitional forms, that would cause problems for my theory, right? He basically says this. Well, now fast forward 150 plus years, and we basically have a pretty good fossil record. You know, I think we've discovered not everything, I'm sure, but, you know, we have a good idea of what it is. And we still see stasis and, you know, the fact that we don't have these sort of transitional forms. So we have these fully formed creatures without any obvious genetic link. And so I actually think that the best explanation for that is the sudden appearance that, you know, something like a special creationist would argue that God basically infused at different times in history, new body plans, new information, and created new species. Now, I don't know the details on that, but it seems that that's the best explanation for some of these big causal joints.
Yeah, so we have transitions within the kinds, but not from one kind to another. Fossil record simply does not bear out Darwin's hypothesis. There's a great quote you use in the book by Hugo de Vries, a Dutchman, I think. I think he was writing in 1905, something like that. But he said, natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it cannot explain the arrival of the fittest. That's a good little turn of phrase to get in your head.
That's right. And that seems right. If you look at the contemporary intelligent design movement there, while you're right, that was 1904, 1905 that DeVries said that, that's still the same kind of idea that's driving much of the ID movement. And the question is, like, how much can the natural selection, that mechanism, that naturalistic mechanism, how much can that really do? And I think the consensus, at least a consensus, is that it can improve existing kinds, but it can't get you new information, right? And that's why there's this sort of revolution in evolution. You do have neo-Darwinians, but you also have non-Darwinian versions of evolution where they're looking for other mechanisms besides natural selection that can account for the rapid increase in information that you see in the fossil records. And that's just kind of an interesting shift, right? A couple of years ago, there was a meeting in the Royal Society of London where, you know, biologists were basically admitting that neo-Darwinian mechanisms just can't get you the kind of information we need in evolution. And you'd think, like, that's a good thing. Oh, maybe they'll all look to God. But that wasn't what happened, right? Because that would be irrational. That would be unscientific, is what we're told. So what they did is it just began to look for other naturalistic mechanisms. And so now you've got a whole menu, you know, 15 to 20 naturalistic mechanisms. And individually or together, those are the mechanisms on the non-Darwinian approaches to evolution that can get us the new information. And anyway, intelligent design folks, I think, have done a really good job exploring those. And their argument, which seems plausible to me, is that those additional mechanisms also come up short.
One of the things you point out in the book, and I think it's something that's worth expanding on, is that we suffer in the modern world from nature deficit, or from maybe we could call it light pollution, where we're stuck in an environment where we really don't see nature, the very lady nature that points us towards a supreme designer.
Right. Yeah, this is this idea that we continue to buffer ourselves and further remove ourselves from reality. And you might think that, like, what's the problem with that, right? Isn't air conditioning and a good thing? And of course it is. But what happens is that so much of modern life, we're mediating our lives through technology and we're living in comfortable homes. I mean, I'm talking to you today from my house here. And what happens, though, is we no longer see the world properly, right? And if part of our job is Christians now is to help others see the world as it is so that they can rightly see the creator behind the world, it's just going to make our job more difficult. Yeah. And so that was what's going on there is given the fact that, you know, even this statistic about how many creatures have become extinct, even what we do see in the world is just a mere fraction of the amazing reality that is the world that God created. And so, Yeah, I wanted to help people see things freshly, and we have to jar them a little bit.
You have to kind of open your eyes and see that we live in an amazing universe on an amazing planet. With respect to human beings, in Chapter 4, you asked the question, can materialism account for the human mind? And I think that's a salient question. The mind and the brain, substance dualism, which I hold to, we say that the mind and the brain are not identical. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, they're correlated, they're tightly integrated, but they're not the same thing. That's right.
Yep. So in golf, oftentimes I say the mind is so incredibly significant because the mind causes the physical synapses of the brain to fire. So where your mind is really has a big impact on how well you play a sport, for example. But yeah, substance dualism, I think, is a really important point. But Daniel Dennett, he said this, if naturalism is true, then there are no conscious minds. Naturalism is true, therefore, there are no conscious minds. So he would say everything's molecules in motion. There is no such thing as a metaphysical reality like the mind.
Right. So, you know, I picked Dennett. He's not the only, he's one strand of the non-religious
story. He's an easy target.
In some ways, he's an easier target, but he's also a prominent voice and a prominent view. What's so interesting, even, you know, this book just came out, but there's a kind of movement in philosophy of mind to what you would call mind-first views of reality, because they're realizing, like, the Dennetts of the world, the atheists, sort of old guard atheists, right, who, like, Russell would be in the stream, Bertrand Russell, and Daniel Dennett's part of maybe the, what for a time were called the new atheists, that are very, you know, hold to a scientism and materialism or physicalism and all those things. That's kind of shifting in the academy, kind of my sense of it, because of the very argument that you read there. It just seems obviously false, right? That consciousness is an illusion, right? And if the first premise that you read there was, if naturalism is true, there are no conscious minds, right? And then premise two, naturalism is true, right? Well, then I would just say there are conscious minds, therefore it's not the case that naturalism is true, right? That seems like more plausible, given the fact that I think we have good reasons to think that I am, and you are, and we are conscious agents. So yeah, I wanted to look at Dennett, but there is an interesting shift that's taking place in the academy because they realize how hard it is to get minds from purely physical things. David Chalmers, who's a leading philosopher of mind, coined the problem of the consciousness as the really hard problem, right? How do you get mental creatures from material things? And that's the real hard problem. And Dennett, of course, is tackling that by denying the phenomena. And that just seems crazy to me.
I had a guest on a few weeks ago, and one of the things he kept pressing is that we should never let anyone try to talk us out of our deep-seated intuitions. And, you know, this is one of those intuitions. You kind of know we have conscious minds, and conscious minds point us to a conscious creator.
Yeah. Or at least it seems like a better fit, right? Because on theism, it's mind first, right? Before there was the physical universe, there was capital R reason, as Lewis puts in his book on miracles, or, you know, there's capital M mind, right? Mind is prior to matter on the theistic view. On the naturalistic story, it's, you know, in the beginning there was matter, and then somehow minds are late and local. Is, I love this phrase. Thomas Nagel wrote a book in 2012 called Mind and Cosmos. He used this wonderful phrase, you know, eventually the universe woke up, right? Eventually this universe was such that minds evolved. And he's right, like, where did minds come from? And Nagel, even in his book Mind and Cosmos, says you can't get minds from a purely naturalistic Darwinian universe. And that's why Nagel and many others are moving to this middle view, that's a mind-first view of reality, that says at the fundamental level of physics, these BBs, whatever they are, whatever the fundamental particles turn out to be, are bits of mental things, right? Because you can't get mental things from physical things. So you need to build the mental things into the foundation of reality itself. So you have this huge shift now, because of the really hard problem, I think, is so intractable. So that's kind of an interesting move that's taking place in the academy right now.
Another signpost is morality. Quick question, is there a moral order? Is the moral order that is objective?
Yeah, that was one of the questions that I think is important to explore. And I think, and the answer that I arrive at is yes, there is an objective moral order. And I think you can see that by the pure light of reason, like you just mentioned, you know, your guest who says, don't let people talk you out of your deeply held intuitions. I think Lewis wonderfully said in his book, Miracles, we can see by the light of reason that we ought to love our neighbor, right? We don't need a syllogism or somebody to teach us that. And I think that's true. We can just see by the light of reason that there is objective moral values and that there are objective moral duties in the universe, right? And in the book, I run through a bunch of what are sometimes called intuition pumps or thought experiments that you can give to see this. But yeah, I think it's pretty clear that there is objective morality. So then the question becomes, what best explains it? And that's kind of where I took it in that chapter.
Yeah. Can atheism account for the guilt that we feel when we do something wrong?
That's right. I think that, you know, the three or four options that I considered in the book for what best explains or grounds objective morality are the universe, nothing, or God, actually. So I guess it was three. And I think that if I were not a theist, if I didn't think that theism offered the best explanation, I would probably go with nothing. What explains objective morality? Nothing does. It's just a brute fact. This is Eric Weilenberg's view. He adopts a view that's sometimes called Platonic atheism. Sometimes it's called brute fact atheism. And I think I would just go there, right? What explains it? Nothing does. It's just a part of the furniture of the world, right? And there's no explanation for it. I think that's the best thing. But notice what that doesn't account for, one of these fundamental features of the moral life that you just brought up, the fact that we feel guilt when we do wrong. And that's an unshakable feeling. What best explains that phenomena, right? And they'll attempt to give like an evolutionary account of that and things like that, but I don't think that those work in the end. So I kind of explore, I actually spent most of my time in that section dealing with Weilenberg, because I think it's the strongest other plausible explanation if you set aside the theistic one.
Meaning also points to the religious story. And as a result of your book, I watched a movie, the 2019 film Joker. In fact, I watched it with one of our staff members. And for some reason or other, the film just didn't appeal to me. I didn't have any interest in watching it. But as a result of you writing about it, I watched the film. And I thought that that was a stroke of brilliance on your part to bring up that film, because it really points to why so many people, or how so many people, could believe that the universe that we live in has no meaning and therefore anything goes. In fact, you know, Alex Rosenberg says, science tells us our longing for a true story of the world is an illusion. There is no place for us. There is no I or self that longs either. There are just the physical facts. The physical facts fix all the facts.
Yeah, that's funny. I was just like you. I didn't want to watch that movie at all. But my son, my college son, was home and wanted to watch it. And I'm so glad we did, right? We had a great conversation. And you're right. It just struck me like, this is about the question of, you know, what is the nature of life? What is the meaning of life, especially if there's no God, right? And one of the pressing questions that I think The Joker, the 2019 movie, presses is this question: is it just tragedy all the way down, right? Is it nihilism? Is there no meaning to life? Or, trying to flip the script, is it comedy all the way down, right? This is nice nihilism. Maybe Rosenberg likes to be a nice nihilist, I think, at times. Yeah, and so I'm glad that I watched the movie too. I did not want to watch it, but it did provoke some thoughts, and I think it was a perfect setup for the foil of exploring. At this point in the book, I've turned the corner. If we're looking at the origin debate, I'm kind of going from phenomena to cause, right? To explanation for phenomena. Here, I'm switching it. Now we're looking at the contour of the human heart, and we're saying, what's the best fit with the things that we find within the human heart, the longings, as I call in this chapter on meaning, I call it the existential set, this set of six things that we long for: purpose, value, significance, intelligibility, identity, and transcendent. And so now I'm looking at these things and saying, what story out there fits in? Is it absurdism, right? Kind of like The Joker, common tragedy all the way down? That doesn't satisfy the deep longings of the heart. Is it nice nihilism like Alex Rosenberg? You know, just let's have fun. There's no meaning in life, but let's party. And if you can't have fun, take Prozac, right? That doesn't fit. And so I kind of catalog and argue that there is a story, what I call enchanted supernaturalism, that is like lock and key, right? That does fit these deep longings of the heart.
You mentioned nice nihilism, and I was struck by some of the examples that you give in your book. For example, the Australian writer Wendy Seifert, she says, I'm just a chunk of meat hurtling through space on a rock, pointless, futile, meaningless. And then she says that was one of the most comforting revelations of her life, because she'd discovered nice nihilism.
Yeah, kind of interesting. This is a new phenomena, right? I think that old guard nihilists were that life is tragedy all the way down. New guard, I don't know if it's more Gen Z, right? New guard nihilists are just like this article that you quoted. There's no meaning to life. Let's go party, you know, let's have fun. Let's make the most of it. And I guess, you know, if my choices were between no meaning of life and tragedy all the way down and comedy all the way down, I'd take nice nihilism, right? Of course. But the problem is, as many have noted, there's this wonderful book by Miroslav Volf on human flourishing, where he makes this point, and I think it's super insightful, that pleasure, which is nice nihilism, just living our life for pleasure, kind of hedonism, pleasure detached from meaning ultimately becomes vapid, right? It doesn't satisfy, it will never satisfy if it's detached from meaning. And so while nice nihilism sounds really fun, especially when we're in our 20s, it quickly becomes, like the Joker in the movie, tragedy all the way down at the end, right? And that's the problem with it. We long for something that, you know, gives us significance and purpose and value. And none of that is around on either version of nihilism.
Yeah, related to this, contrast enchanted naturalism with unenchanted naturalism.
Okay, good. So yeah, the four possible stories that I review in that this chapter on meaning are, you know, ask this question, is there a meaning landscape? In the same way we could ask, is there a moral landscape? And nihilism, the two versions of nihilism that say there is no meaning landscape are absurdism and nice nihilism. And then there's a version of naturalism that says, no, there is a meaning landscape. It's just subjective, right? It's just found within culture and individual humans within culture. And so you have Owen Flanagan, who's also at Duke University, philosopher. He writes a book. So it's interesting. I mentioned Chalmers, who says that consciousness is the hard problem. The title of Flanagan's book is The Really Hard Problem. Subtitle, Finding Meaning in a Materialistic World. That's the really hard problem. And so what Flanagan does, and I admire the effort here, right? Is that he says we can get a kind of meaning in life, even though there's no meaning of life, we can get a meaning in life, and that's good enough, right? So there's a kind of subjective landscape, and that's what he's trying to do in that chapter. And he grounds it in culture and society and, you know, the 21st century and things like that. The thing that's kind of interesting about that, though, or the problem, if you read the Meaning of Life literature, Josh Sechrist is a wonderful philosopher who writes on this, and he talks about the problem of the end. And on enchanted naturalism, we know the end of the story. The end of the story is that the human species at some point ceases to exist because the universe will at some point cease to exist. And the problem of the end is that knowing the ending of the story infects our enjoyment and meaning that we can find in it now. It's just like if you're going on a date, this is his example. If you went on a date with someone, but you knew you would never marry that person, it's going to kind of affect how you view the date, right? It's not something you're going to invest in. And that's the problem of the end. And that's the problem with enchanted naturalism, is we know at the end there is no objective at the widest level possible. You know, there's no meaning of life, and that affects the meaning in life that we find today.
So there is no such thing as enchanted naturalism, but there is such a thing as enchanted supernaturalism.
I think at the end of the day, that's the only option, right, that works. Number one, it has a perfect fit with that existential set. Number two, you have instances of enchanted supernaturalism like Christianity that have widely explored this. I think of Pascal and his famous, you know, this is paraphrasing, but the God-shaped void that we've been created with that only God will satisfy. You've got the wonderful chapter by C.S. Lewis. I think it's this chapter in Heaven in The Problem of Pain, but he talks about how the human soul is like lock and key or hand and glove, you know, meant to fit with God and the Christian story. And so you have instances of enchanted supernaturalism that do help us get a rich picture of not just meaning in life, but the fact that there's this overall meaning of life because God exists and God is the ground of it. So that's kind of where I end on that one. Hopeful chapter.
One of the signposts that you have us take a deep look at is happiness. And you point out that there are a lot of counterfeits to happiness. So the relentless pursuit of pleasure, for example, is a counterfeit. You say, in fact, if you relentlessly pursue pleasure, you're going to end up enslaved.
Right. Yeah. I love, there's this quote, I don't have it at the top of my, you know, fingers, by David Foster Wallace, who was a wonderful writer, died tragically, early suicide. But he basically says about worship that money prestige, pleasure. You know, he says that these things, if you make them your idol, I'm switching the language, but if you make them the thing that you think will satisfy, they will eat you up, right? That they just ultimately will create miserable people. But on the other hand, in culture, at least popularly, because we no longer ask preliminary questions, what is happiness? We just sort of imbibe this idea, because maybe part of the American dream, that happiness is fame or fortune or pleasure or success. And so I wanted to explore those and really give them their due, right? Because we all want to be happy. That's something that we begin with. Everyone longs for happiness. If you ask any person, what do you want most out of life? Their answer is, I just want to be happy. Well, then we should at least consider what happiness amounts to and if we can ever attain it. And so in there, we have, at this point in the story, I've invited other fellow guides. So along with Lady Nature, Lady Philosophy has joined us at this point. And she was actually with us all along, but I'm interacting with Boethius. Yeah, she's identifiable. That's right. Yeah, but because I was interacting with Boethius, who in fifth century, he wrote this book called The Consolation of Philosophy, where he's basically thrown in jail. He's awaiting his execution and he's basically out of mind, as he puts it. And so Lady Philosophy appears to him and says, you've lost the path of reason. And he's questioning, was I happy? Right? I had all these things. Now they're gone. What is happiness? And so Boethius, with Lady Philosophy as his guide, personified wisdom, they explore in that book these very questions that are relevant to the 21st century, way back in the 5th century. And Boethius considers every one of those contemporary versions. You know, happiness is wealth, success, fame, pleasure, and they find them, with Lady Philosophy's help, wanting. And then, of course, they arrive on what the nature of true happiness is. And for Boethius, no surprise, it's something about union with God. And so I kind of unpack that a little bit in this book, but that was the foil there.
Yeah, you also say to be happy, it's necessary to connect pleasure with meaning.
That's right. So it's not like pleasure, fame, success, wealth are bad things. It's just that they're not ultimate things, right? And as it turns out, on the Christian story, every one of those are ingredients in our happiness, but they're ingredients. They're not the thing itself. And even in the Christian story, you know, I love, again, C.S. Lewis, The Weight of Glory, this essay that he wrote called The Weight of Glory. Part of the weight of glory that we have as humans, glory in the sense of fame, there's two senses for glory. One is excellence, a kind of virtue, kind of perfection. The other is fame. Well, we have both senses of that. In the afterlife, we become an ingredient in God's happiness. That's the weightiness of the human person. And we also have a kind of fame, right, in the face of God in the afterlife and in now as well as believers. And so all these things are important, and that's why they're important to discuss, but they're just ingredients, not the thing itself.
Yeah, we're created for a distant land. Your chapter on pain, I love this chapter. I so often think of Charles Haddon Spurgeon when he said, were you ever in the melting pot, dear friends? I have been there and my sermons with me. The result of melting is that you arrive at a true valuation of things and then you're poured out in new and better fashion. So you can almost hope for the melting pot. You can almost hope for pain and suffering because then you arrive at a true valuation of things. So do pain and suffering give us reason to think that God does not exist or the inverse?
Good. So we're certainly told that, right? In fact, you know this, Hank, but the number one argument when you look at the arguments for or against God's existence, the number one argument on the atheist side is the problem of evil. You know, either God cannot exist or God probably doesn't exist given the amount, the distribution, and the horrific nature of evil and suffering. So it certainly is cashed out as an argument against the existence of God. And of course, any book that is honestly trying to explore the true story of the world has to deal with the problem of pain, right? And suffering and evil. And so it's super important to deal with that. And so, yeah, so as it turns out, I think that Christianity offers, I think, the best explanation, or I should say God's answer to the problem of pain. I love Peter Crafe, wrote a wonderful book called Making Sense of Suffering. And he basically ends this with hey, you know, we can go through all the standard arguments against and for, you know, arguments from evil, and we can rebut them as theists, but then, you know, those are a bunch of propositions, but the problem is an existential problem, and it's personal, and so it demands an existential and personal response. And so Crafe says God's answer to the problem of pain and suffering is Christ on a cross, and that's a personal answer, right? It's one better than mere theism, and I think at the end of the day, that's exactly right. Christianity alone gives, I think, the most satisfying answer to this question, because you get the God of love, who pursues his creation, his creatures who have run from him, and takes on all pain and all suffering on himself so that one day we can experience freedom from that pain and suffering. There was a study done years ago, like if you could ask God one question, what would it be? I think Barna ran the study. And the number one question is, why, God, do you allow pain and suffering? And so one writer calls this question, why, God, do you allow pain and suffering, like a fish hook that's, you know, tugging at the human heart. And I think that that's right. And so we have to take it seriously. But at the end of the day, it just reveals a God of love who makes provisions for fallen creatures that we could be made whole.
The chapter's a brilliant chapter, and you quote perhaps the forerunner to Darwin in the 4th century, Epicurus. And he said this, and I'd love for you to cash this out a little bit. He said, is God willing to prevent evil, but not able? Well, then he's impotent. Is he able, but not willing? Well, then he's malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Well, then whence then is evil? So he lays this out in such a way that the only answer to the question seems to be, well, God is either the author of evil, he's impotent, he's malevolent, but if there's evil, then there can't be a God. Certainly not a good God.
Yes. You know, whenever I teach on this, this is a great starting place for this in a philosophy class, because what Epicurus is raising there is what's called the logical problem of evil. And that's just simply the claim that the existence of evil is logically inconsistent with the existence of a holy good and holy powerful God, right? Because if he was all good, he would eliminate it. If he was all powerful, he could eliminate it, but we have it. So this is a logical problem. And anything, of course, that's a contradiction is necessarily false. And so if God and evil are a logical contradiction and evil exists, well, then of course God doesn't exist. It's called the logical problem of evil. I'll just report that almost everyone working in this area in philosophy and theology thinks that the logical problem of evil has been solved. This is one of the few cases where we actually see genuine progress in philosophy, or at least it's one of the areas we can point to and say, here's genuine progress. And how that story usually goes is that Alvin Plantinga, who's an important Christian philosopher, solved the logical problem of evil in the 1970s with his really technical book on the nature of necessity. And then he applied this kind of contemporary logic, contemporary metaphysics to the problem of evil and showed how there's no logical contradiction. And he offered what's called the free will defense. And he just shows, given human freedom, it is not possible that God could cause us to freely only choose the good, right? So there's no contradiction between evil and God, because God allows us to be the certain kinds of creatures that are self-determiners of our actions and our character and our lives. And given that, he permits it, but we actualize it. And so that's kind of the quick thumbnail sketch of one solution to the logical problem. I go a little further than that, but that is what most people begin with in arguing that this has been solved.
Yeah, it raises a couple of issues. Can the Christian worldview exist plausibly without the concept of free will?
Okay, good. I love that. I'm pausing because I will upset half my Christian brethren here. But yeah, I have a view that no, free will is part of what it means to be human, and that I have a particular view of free will that's some version of what's called incompatibilism, or sometimes it's called libertarianism. The version I hold is a version of source incompatibilism called virtue libertarianism. So there's a whole long story there that I could give you. But the basic idea is that we are creatures that can shape our own lives, and that we have a kind of power available to us such that we are self-determiners of our character, our actions, and our very life story. So we have real skin in the game. And I think that without that, we don't have a story, right? We don't have a good story, certainly, right? If we're just, you know, determined to act a certain way or things like that. And so, yeah, I do think that free will is essential to what it means to be human. And of course, there's a lot of debate about this, but some people would even root that in the fact that we're created in the image of God. God is an intellect and a will. Humans have an intellect and a will. God is free in this, I think, virtue libertarian sense. And there's good reasons to think that we are too. So there's a whole lot there, that can of worms, but that's my quick thought.
Yeah, sorry to get you into hot water.
That's all good.
You make a statement, and I mean, there's an easy explanation to this, but you say God can't do everything. You know, we think God can do anything. You say, no, he can't. And if you think about it, You're absolutely dead right, but at first blush, it sounds wrong. God can't do everything. He can't do anything that's possible.
Right. I do a lot of speaking like at Summit Ministries to high school students in the summer, and they get up in arms when I say this. You know, I usually ask, how many people think God can do anything, right? This is omnipotence. This is all powerful. And pretty much everybody raises their hand, but that's never in the history of the Christian tradition, never been the definition of omnipotence. It's always been something like God can do anything that's logically consistent and doesn't go against his holy good nature, right? So God can't create a square circle. God can't create a married bachelor. God can't cause free creatures to do only the good and things like that. God can't do evil. Like, there's tons of things that God can't do because he's holy good and he's perfectly rational. And so, yeah, it does sound at first not so great, but it actually, if God could do the logically impossible, well, then he wouldn't be perfectly rational, and then he wouldn't be worthy of our worship. So it cuts both ways, right? So we need to be careful when we make our claims. But yeah, the traditional view, and even in scripture, God cannot lie, right? That's in Hebrews. Even in scripture, there's things that God cannot do. So it's okay to say that, because that's in fact what it means.
You make another bold claim, and that is the claim that there's no such thing as pointless evil. I think this is a really important point.
Right. So if the logical problem of evil has been solved, let's say, almost everybody agrees. There's at least two atheistic philosophers I know that think that Plantinga and others didn't solve the logical problem, but most, including William Rowe, Paul Draper, who I interact with in the chapter, others say, no, we solved the logical problem. Let's move on to what's called the evidential problem. The evidential problem just says, given all this evil, probably God doesn't exist, because for all we can tell, much of the evil and suffering we see in the world is completely pointless. Now, there are some theists like Peter Van Inwagen that will agree and say, yeah, there is some pointless evil in the world. But most theists are not willing to go there, and I don't want to go there either. Your listeners might not want all this detail, but I agree with Eleanor Stump, who's a wonderful philosopher, who she has a high bar for theodicies. Theodicies are giving God justifying reasons for evil. She has what's called a person-centric bar, such that the evil and suffering that happens to you must be for your benefit, not for humanity in general, not for some other creature, but for the person undergoing the suffering. That's a very high bar for giving a reason for God allowing evil. And Stump's answer then, given that high bar, which is one that I'm super attracted to, is that the only reasons why God allows evil and suffering in any person's life is for one of two reasons. Number one, either to prevent that person from further distancing themselves from God, their highest good, or number two, to draw them closer to their highest good, which is God. And those are the only two, basically, two reasons for allowing evil. And I'm really attracted to that view. And one of the reasons why this view works and only works is because you have to extend the God-justifying reasons into the afterlife, right? I think that Tolkien's insight at the end of The Lord of the Rings, when Sam, you know, and Frodo are back at the Shire, and Sam's like, why are you leaving? He's going off to the Grey Havens. And Frodo says, you know, hey, there's some wounds that time cannot heal, right? The intuition is that some of our wounds in this world, I don't think will totally heal, but in the afterlife, right, all of those things will be made right again. And I'm pretty attracted to that view. I don't know how I got here from your question, but that's where I'll stop.
No, that's a good answer. I was thinking as you're speaking, I just quoted this at a wedding of one of my daughters last weekend. It's called The Weaver. I was in a restaurant in Southern California, and I saw this placemat in a Coco's, actually. And it had this little poem, and I decided to memorize it. And I've used it many times, but I think it sort of explains what we're talking about. It goes something like this. My life is but a weaving between my Lord and me. I do not choose the colors. He weaveth steadily. Oft times he weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride. Forget he sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly will God unfurl the canvas and explain the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. So suffering really has significant impact in our lives. I mean, suffering, we can say credibly, God uses suffering for good.
Yeah, right. And part of the thing, this is one of the, there's a number of places in the book where I'm sharing a little bit more personal about my story, but I share a time when I actually experienced a great loss in my own life And I actually was reading Eleanor Stump, this person I just mentioned, her book, Wandering in Darkness, and she named it. And it was heartbreak. And so here I was, a philosophy professor who's taught for decades on the problem of evil, but I didn't know what heartbreak was. And suddenly I'm at this place where I have this feeling at the level of my gut that this is what it means to be broken and stripped of a deep longing of the heart, actually. And then I had like different eyes to see. You're right. Like suddenly I'm in the grocery store, I'm at the restaurant, and I'm looking around at the faces. I'm like, oh, there's heartbreak over there. And there it is there. And so it's actually helped me. You're right. So going through this suffering in my own life, not embarrassed to say, but my life has been pretty easy. But going through that period of suffering gave me eyes to see and to really appreciate the importance of wrestling with this and that God is good even there. Yeah.
You have a chapter, I love this chapter, chapter 9. It's simply titled Love. What is love?
This is one of my favorite chapters. Actually, the love and beauty one, we're finally getting to the beauty that I just really loved writing. Okay, so what is love and why include it? Well, it seems to be something that we think is of great value. And I love what I was really struck by, I've been reading on the virtues for years, and I was reading Joseph Pieper, who's a Catholic theologian, philosopher who writes on the virtues, and I was reading his chapter on love. And he has this wonderful little sentence where he says the fundamental affirmation of love is I'm glad that you exist. I'm glad that you are. And I can remember reading that for the first time thinking, that's right. That's profound. And that's right. That's what love's fundamental affirmation is. And so I wanted to explore this. This is like, you know, in a work on apologetics or cultural apologetics, we don't usually think about the argument from love to God, but there is one. And so what I did is spent some time looking at the nature of love. And then I asked, what is the best explanation for this deep love that we do see in the world? What is love? Well, it has at least five features that we notice. It's multi-directed, right? We can love things and food and people. It's complex. It's deep and enduring. It's active and passive. And of course, it's of deep value. And so then the question was, what best explains those features of love? And I had a chance to look at the contemporary literature. And there's actually a rich tradition of philosophy of love. And I canvassed those only to discover that Aquinas, the 13th century monk, celibate monk, probably got it right. And for Aquinas, I'm convinced that this is the best account of love that I've found. Love is the desire for two things. Love is the desire for the well-being of the beloved and union with the beloved. And that seems to capture the phenomenology, the features of love that I experience in my own life and that I think others experience in theirs as well.
You point out that if you take the non-religious story, love comes into the picture very late in the game. I mean, I suppose that's true of Islam as well. For Islam, you have a Unitarian God. A Unitarian God doesn't have an object apart from the universe to love, and therefore is morally deficient, doesn't have the attribute of love. But in either case, if we just go to the naturalistic worldview, love comes into the picture late.
Yeah, right. It's not fundamental to reality. It's late and it's local for all we know. You know, it's in one place. And so then what's interesting is you can run an argument from the kind of deep love that I articulate there, that's basically Aquinas's view, to theism. And it goes something like this. It's very simple in the book, you know, hey, given naturalism, this kind of love is really surprising, right? Because it's late and local and it's like an evolutionary byproduct of survival. But on theism, it's not surprising. Therefore, according to a rule of inference called the likelihood principle, the existence of love provides strong evidence for the existence of theism. So why is love not surprising on theism? Well, on the Christian story, love is at the center of reality itself, right? Like I love your point. I hadn't actually thought about that with the Unitarian God of Islam versus the Trinitarian God of Christianity. At the heart of the Trinitarian God is love, right? This is the most fundamental fact of reality. It's a relational fact, and it's a fact about love. And so it wouldn't be surprising, given that fundamental reality is love itself, that this loving being would create a universe with creatures that can love. And that's actually a piece of evidence that can figure into a pretty cool argument from love to the God of theism.
Yeah, maybe this is regressing a little bit in terms of the book, but I think it's important to the overall structure of the book. Explain your use of conceptual landscapes.
Well, I think that It goes back to something that J.P. Moreland, my first philosophy professor, drilled into my mind. And my students who I teach now will recognize this comment. But J.P. said, if you want to be good thinkers, you need to learn to make distinctions. And if you want to be good teachers, you need to learn to teach distinctions. And that has been something that I have followed for years. I think that it's important to ask the right preliminary questions and get clear on the concepts that we're talking about, because by the light of reason, we shine our light on reality and we discover truth. And if we're after discovering the true story of the world, we have to think as carefully and as clearly and as methodically as we can. And this is a skill that we've lost. So that's why I try to do a bunch of, you know, conceptual landscape kind of work all throughout the book. And I try to do it, I will say, with some humor and with some stories along the way, but it's super important that we think clearly about these important matters.
Your chapter on beauty, loved it. Why do you think that beauty is ultimately objective? Some people would say that's ridiculous. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You say, no, that's not true.
Yeah. Well, because we need to look at the phenomena and ask what best explains the phenomena. And for at least, well, two reasons that are coming to mind. There's many. Number one, we disagree about beautiful things, and that the fact that we have disagreements and that we think people are wrong is best explained by there being objective aesthetic facts in the world. So that's one reason, and I could give an argument for that. One thing that I found really interesting, though, because I've been working a little bit on philosophy of science and thinking about theory construction and metaphysics, which is the area I work in philosophy. And what's so interesting, when you're doing your mature theories, like in metaphysics or in science, you appeal to theoretical virtues, because theoretical virtues are supposed to be truth indicative, right? So if your theory has more virtues than some competing theory, well, then you go with the one with the most virtues, because those virtues are truth indicative. What's so interesting is the theoretical virtues are all aesthetic, simplicity, elegance, uniformity, right? Scope. These are all aesthetic things. And many thinkers have noticed throughout history that truth and beauty are tightly aligned. In fact, in our theory assessment, truth and beauty are tightly aligned. There's an argument from the indispensability of aesthetic properties to the objective existence of aesthetic facts. So those are just two reasons. I think it's like looking at the sunset. Wouldn't that be foolish to say, oh, that's just beautiful to you, right? Looking at, yeah, I live in Jupiter, Florida. It's like paradise. Looking at the palm tree outside my window, right? We would think that they are wrong if they look at these things and think they're not actually objectively beautiful.
Yeah, so one of the quotes you use, I love this, Peter Forrest, I just laughed out loud when I read this. He presses the implausible consequence of aesthetic relativism, or saying, well, beauty is just in the eye of the beholder. And this is the quote, it's worth reading. How ugly the stars are tonight. How trivial the pounding of the waves on the beach. And is it not crass to be thrilled by mountains? The rainforest and the wildflowers are quite repulsive. And as for sunsets and dot, 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 you read that quote and you say, yeah, beauty is not just in the eyes of the beholder. There is objective beauty.
Yeah. So then the question becomes, what do we do with that fact, right? If so, now notice what's happening to our universe. We began with physical facts, looking at the universe, Lady Nature. Then we started looking at like moral facts and meaning facts. And now we're looking at aesthetic facts. Suddenly our universe is quite interesting, right? There's all these features of the world that are way more rich than the scientific view of the world sometimes tells us on the non-religious story. So again, we ask what best explains it. And you can run the very same kind of argument that I ran in the argument from love. I look at two specific features of objective beauty in the world and argue on theism, they're best explained, and naturalism, they're utterly surprising. And those two features are, number one, that the world is saturated with beauty. From the heavens above to the microscopic below, everywhere we turn our mind's eye, including the laws of nature itself, we find beauty, right? It's saturated. Now, think of the analogy with an artist, a human artist. A human artist can create beautiful things. Because of my research on beauty, I'm trying to learn how to draw, because I want to learn to see the world. And I think that that will help me to learn to see the world better, maybe, if I can develop some art. And I know, because I'm really bad at it, that it's hard to create beautiful portraits, landscapes, right? But an artist can do that. If nature and natural processes are all that there is in the universe, you wouldn't expect the universe to be saturated with beauty, because it's hard to create beauty. You'd expect it and maybe, you know, get lucky in different pockets of the world maybe, or something like that, but it's saturated. That's one piece of evidence. The second piece of evidence is what philosophers, theologians, and sociologists have noted throughout history, including atheists, is that beauty has a kind of transcendent quality to it. It's evocative of the eternal, as one would put it. From Plato on, they've noticed this. And even the atheist says, given this evocative nature, the universe is kind of a sham, right? So you want to take these two facts, the fact that the world is saturated with beauty and the fact that it's suggestive of like a kind of personal communication, a transcendent nature to it. What best explains that? Well, on naturalism, again, that would be surprising. On theism, given God himself is the source of beauty, or beauty itself, it's not surprising. So beauty, as it turns out, is another powerful reason to think that God exists.
You've already touched on this, but maybe to elaborate on this a little more, even when you talk about how you've started to draw, because it gives you a concept, an understanding of the world, the beauty of the world, and that leads you to the religious story or the Christian worldview. What is the chief value of art? And why is it so important that art remains art and doesn't become random and distorted?
I love this. I taught a class here at PBA on philosophy and literature, but it was really our philosophy of art class for part of that. And we read Gordon Graham's book, Philosophy, Introduction to Philosophy of the Arts. And in there, and I talk about this in the book we're talking about, Good and True Story, I talk about these different theories. I'm convinced the view that it's called aesthetic cognitivism, but it's just the view that the chief value of art is cognitive. And what he means, the chief value of art is it helps us understand the world around us, or the human experience of the world. That's what art does. It's kind of like, and this is what I love about artists, and I think philosophers can play this role too. Artists are men and women who basically pull that curtain back on reality and help us get a glimpse, I think, of prime reality the way that it really is, right? That's the benefit of art. You could even give like an eschatological function or telos to art. That good art, I think, helps us see what reality one day in the transformed, renewed heavens and earth will be like. That's what art does. It's evocative of the divine, but it helps us to see, understand, and appreciate reality. And ultimately, I think, done well, it can lead us to worship.
Yeah, and as you just alluded to, it points us to the divine artist.
That's right.
Yeah. Religion, your last chapter, fantastic chapter. I mean, the book just keeps getting better as you go through it. And I hope we've done justice to the book, because when you read it, it's just intoxicating. You can't stop reading it because you tell wonderful stories and you just have a gift for doing this. But how do you define religion?
Good. Yeah. Good. I thought in any book seeking to discover the true story of the world, we should talk about the thing that the majority of humans in the history of our species have engaged in, which is religious activities. Religiare is the Latin word to bind. And so religion is seeking to unite heaven and earth, God and man. And that's, you know, in generic terms, what religion is. And this chapter, actually, you know, I have guides in the book along the way. I'm inviting guides to kind of help point us in the right direction. In this last chapter, this is the most personal, where I share some of my own journey coming to faith in Christ and just kind of share a little bit about that. But yeah, so it begins with all the religions can't be true because they contradict each other, right? I feel like I thought that it would be important to state that, because that moves away from this sort of false idea that's out there sometimes that all religions are equal paths to God, right? I think we need to move beyond that to discover the true story of the world, the true religion that God founded. And that moves us off of that purely logical blunder that they're all religions are the same to the question of evidence. And so I just share briefly the evidence that was persuasive to me as a freshman in college was, among other things, the evidence for the resurrection. And I just briefly go into it there, more sharing my biography than the actual evidence, but I'm pointing the reader to it and helping them see that all the clues that we've been exploring, all of them converge on this good, well, this true story, and it turns out to be a good story. And if you go all the way back to the book I wrote, Cultural Apologetics, my definition of cultural apologetics was that we want to help others see that Christianity is not just true to the way the world is, but it's true to the way the world ought to be. That it's both good and beautiful. and true, right? And that's what I wanted to end with, was not only did we discover the true story, but it satisfies all the longings of the heart in a way that's, we discover our true name. And as it turns out, that true name, and this is where I end, is Beloved on the Christian story.
Expand on something that you just touched on very briefly. I think it's worth expanding on. The idea that all religions can be false, but they can't all be true.
Good. Yeah, this is just a point of logic. Given the law of non-contradiction, two mutually exclusive statements cannot be true at the same time in the same sense, right? So if we just take two religions and boil it down to a set of propositions that they claim, within the Christian faith, you would find a proposition affirmed that Jesus is God or divine. And within like the Islamic faith, you would have a proposition that's the negation of that. Jesus is not divine, right? So just on a pure logical point, one of those statements is true and the other is false. Either Jesus is or isn't divine, right? And so if that's a central claim that is like at the foundation of these religions, well, it just follows that either Christianity is true or Islam is true, but not both. And you're right, all of the religions could be false. It could be some other thing out there that we haven't determined, but they can't all be true because they contradict each other on these central features about the nature of reality, the nature of God, man's fundamental problem, and God's solution.
Yeah, I think probably the best way to wrap up this podcast is to talk about the Christian story a little bit. You just alluded to the resurrection. We're pointing out, as you do so eloquently in the book, that God created the universe. There's no question about that. That thread runs throughout the book. The heavens declare the glory of God, as I mentioned earlier, as the psalmist put it. But you also point out that Jesus Christ is God and demonstrates that he's God through the immutable fact of his resurrection. And St. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 doesn't ask us to believe that or accept it on blind faith, but rather he makes a four-part argument for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You know, Jesus Christ suffered fatal torment, the tomb was empty, Christianity cannot survive an identifiable tomb containing the corpse of Christ. Christ appeared, gave many convincing proofs that he was alive, and as a result of that, his followers were irrevocably transformed, and they end up transforming the world. And then we can point to the Bible as saying that that is a reliable source for faith and practice. So the Christian worldview corresponds to reality. And that Christian worldview corresponding to reality has obviously transformed you as well.
Yeah, you're right. So as a back to my story, as a freshman in college, I was confronted with the claims of Christ. And I realized, wait a minute, if that's Christianity, then I guess I missed the boat because I didn't believe that Jesus was divine and I didn't believe that Christianity was the religion founded by God. And so that actually set me on a journey. I now know that it's not normal what I did, but one of my friends in the dorm, Mike, who's still a dear friend of mine today, but as an 18-year-old freshman, the first thing he said to me was, hey, I'm a Christian and I'm not going to condemn you when you get drunk. And I said, okay, cool. And I went to Mike after hearing about the gospel and asked him more about it. And so basically he took me to an apologetics class for my whole freshman year. So every week I'd go into this church as a non-believer and I would go into this classroom with a bunch of other students and this professor, and he'd have a stack of books, on the table, and we'd talk about the topic. And every week after the class, they'd ask me, what do you think of the evidence, Paul? And I'd be like, it's pretty interesting. It's pretty persuasive. And they would say, at some point, you need to make a decision. And I would say, yeah, you're probably right. And that was about how it was for about a year. But I was just persuaded over time that this is true. And for me, at the end of the day, after that year of exploring, I realized it wasn't an intellectual issue. Like St. Augustine, who was convinced intellectually that Christianity was true, I realized that it was now a moral issue. I didn't want to bend my will. That free will that we talked about, right? I wanted to be the master of my own universe. And then as the story progressed, so I was back home in Wisconsin, where I'm from. After my freshman year, I was reading the Bible at the time, not a believer, but seeking. And actually, I was reading Revelation. And at some point in that summer, I was reading Revelation thinking, all right, I know this is true. I'd kind of be a fool not to give my whole life to it. And so at some point that summer, God just convicted me of it's, time for me to bend my knee and then I'm all in. And so that was it. I knew that I didn't want to be a kind of a fence sitter. It was either all in or all out, but I was just convinced that it was true. So I jumped in. And what I have found, from that moment on is that Christianity really is this true story that satisfies, right? And that's what we want. We want to be rightly related to reality and we want to experience life the way it was meant to be. And as it turns out, our highest objective good is union with God, and that corresponds to the deepest longing of the heart, which is union with God. As Augustine said in the Confessions, in the first paragraph, our hearts are restless until their hearts find rest in you, O God. And that was my journey. My heart was restless. I didn't know it, but it was restless until I found rest in God. And so grateful that I get to do the things I do now and hopefully point others back to Christ as Christ has nourished me, you know, and helped me to find the true story of the world.
Yeah, Vladimir Orlovsky said that Christian theology in the last resort is a means. It is a unity of knowledge subserving an end that transcends all knowledge, the very end that you point to, union with God. We are created for union with God. Any time during your Christian walk that you were disappointed with the Christian worldview or disillusioned?
Yeah, that's good. I think early on as an 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old, I probably struggled with moral issues just coming from a non-Christian background. But I don't think that was a disillusion with the Christian worldview. That was more a disillusion with my own sense of character and sinful nature that needed to grow in Christ. I think probably, though, the other time with the Christian worldview, and this was pretty minor, was actually during my PhD studies. And it wasn't even a disillusionment, but it was a beating down of my soul. It's hard. I tell this to my students who want to do PhD work in philosophy, that there's a cost to your soul. There's a physical cost, too, to doing a PhD. And for me, I went to a wonderful program at Purdue, like you mentioned at the beginning. But even there, I could feel my soul being beat down as I would sit in a seminar on Spinoza. And we'd sit around the seminar and everybody would make fun of Christians because Spinoza's making fun of the Bible, you know? And over time, you just weary. And so what happened was, I don't think I was ever disillusioned with the gospel or Christianity. In fact, I was a campus minister through my time as a PhD student, and I was doing ministry and walking with the Lord during that time. But what I realized after graduating, after getting the degree, was I needed about a year where I realized I needed to fall in love with Jesus again. Like, just savor Jesus without preparing for a Bible study, without preparing to lead a lecture, but just to be with him. And I think that Tim Keller at the time was super nourishing to me. And the, you know, the phrase where he said things like, you know, the greatest need that we have prior to Christ is the gospel. And what is the greatest need that you have even after Christ? It's the gospel. And just the idea of it, for me at the time, it was just brought me back to the cross, brought me back to Christ, and just realizing that, yeah, I made it through this PhD program intact, but my heart, you know, was beat down and Christ nourished and built that back up. And so now I just try to incorporate those practices daily into my own journey of being nourished on the word of Christ, the spirit of Christ throughout my day and all that stuff.
Well, you're an amazing person, an amazing writer. I think I should just close with what J.P. Moreland said about your book. He, of course, distinguished professor, Talbot School of Theology, Biola University, author of a book that I like, A Simple Guide to Miracles. But he said this about your book: it's very accessible, it's conversational, it's full of stories and illustrations, and they're just used in such an effective manner. That's my ad lib. And then he says, this is now the best book to give to an unbelieving friend or relative. And that's one of the reasons I had you on the podcast. I mean, I hope people will get this book. It's available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. I promise you, it is not dry and dusty. It is alive. You'll read it. You'll laugh out loud. You'll be engaged throughout the whole process. And in the end, you'll have these 11 cairns, these 11 signposts that will follow you throughout the rest of your life. And when the winds of doubt and disbelief beat upon your house of faith, you can go back to those signposts and you can be fortified. Those pillars or posts will fortify you in your faith. So this is a book not only to give to an unbeliever, but I think it's a book that you can read through yourself and be revitalized in your faith. And when you're revitalized in your faith, you become revitalized in becoming a torchbearer for that faith, sharing the faith with others, always being ready to give an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within you with gentleness and with respect. This book is, like the author, interesting, informative, and inspirational. Get a copy of the book. You can find it on the web at equip.org or write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. And for everyone tuning in, thank you so much for your support of this podcast. Look forward to seeing you next time with another Hank Unplugged.